creepy and they're kooky. They're serious and spooky. They're all together looky. The Addams Family. Their house is a museum. When people come to see them, they really are a squeam. The Addams Family.
Neat. Sweet.
So get a witch's shawl on, a broomstick you can crawl on. We're gonna pay a call on the Addams Family.
Turning to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman, and we're continuing with our program, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, with Richard Haass and E.J. Dionne.
Back there, please. That gentleman. Wait for the mic, if you would.
Mark Lagon, Georgetown University and the Council. Richard, you started out by saying that we ought not to be tilting at windmills and looking for interventions in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. But to say that we shouldn't pursue interventions to shape new regimes doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't focus on the Middle East and Southwest Asia. So the Arab Spring has happened. Don't we have to engage that process? Right. And if we don't, is it not living in a gated community?
Fair enough. And when interventions is sometimes shorthands for military interventions, just to be clear. And yes, let me make clear that not acting is just as much of a policy as acting. Now, so with a case like Egypt, I would say, sure, the United States should engage. The most important dimensions there are political and economic. And I would simply say that that's a perfect, Egypt's what, one-third to one-quarter of the Arab world. We have a stake in its outcome. We ought to make clear, here's the kind of outcomes we want. Here's the economic incentives we're willing to put on the table if you move in those directions. It's your sovereign decision whether to move in those directions and qualify for that support. It's our sovereign right to make our aid conditional. So yes, we have influence. Our influence, however, is less than our interests. We can't dictate those outcomes. So I think there we engage it, if you will, diplomatically and economically, and we simply make clear to the Egyptians that their choices will have consequences for their relationship with us. With Syria, we have a different set of tools. And there I would say, we're obviously massive economic help to help with refugee flows, all sorts of support, and I would be willing to favor on a selective basis lethal support for Syrian oppositionists who met certain criteria that we would put forward. But then I also think there's got to be limits on what it is we do. So again, coming back to one of EJ's point, inconsistency is unavoidable. This is not an argument for a hands-off foreign policy. It is an argument for a discriminating foreign policy, a tailored foreign policy for each situation, based upon not just our interests, but a realistic assessment of what we can achieve at a certain cost, given local realities, and what is it else we've got to keep in mind given the full range of interests we have, foreign policy and domestic policy. But I want us to be involved, but it just in a fairly discriminating way.
You know, at one point in the book, you talk about two distinctions we need to make. One is between the desirable and the vital, and the other is between the feasible and the impossible.
Sure.
And I think that goes to the point. Way back there on the left side, and then the lady on the right side.
Chris Broughton, a Millennium Challenge Corporation. I was pleased to see you touch the topic of entitlements. And both, I think we need to think about this in the context of entitlement, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, but also tax expenditures. And so I think the utility of your contribution here is to add the national security and foreign policy dimension to those issues, which have largely been seen in an economic competitiveness and demographic context. And so my question to you is whether you see how you see the national security and foreign policy dimensions of the entitlement challenge and the tax expenditure challenge affecting either the incentives and the calculations of voters, the representatives on Capitol Hill, and their leadership both in Congress and in the White House.
And if I could piggyback on that, I was surprised in the book that you talked about the possibility of modest defense cuts. You're not averse to cutting the defense budget for now.
Yeah.
If you could take those two
let
together.
Let me take the last one first. Look, far more important than how much we spend on defense, within limits, is how we spend it. The question of, I can give you a better defense for $475 billion than some would give for $500 billion, depending upon how that money's allocated. But so often the debate about defense spending is almost symbolic. And if you're in favor of the full request, you're pro-defense and you're a hardliner. And if you're in favor of a 8% cut or something, that makes you anti-defense. Well, not necessarily. It all depends on the details. And that's true, by the way, of public policy. Look at health care. We average twice the spending on health care of every other country in the OECD, yet our outcomes aren't any better. So clearly how much we're spending on health care is not the key. Well, we spend an awful lot on education in K-12, yet the outcomes don't compare very well with a lot of the world. So how much we're spending on K-12 education, again, is not necessarily the decisive point. So why is defense different? There's just as many choices with defense spending. So let's be smart about defense. Now, obviously, at some point, if the cuts are draconian enough, there's no way to do it smart or do it right. But what I think Congress ought to do is, once the ceilings are decided, give defense leadership much more discretion in making the choices under the ceiling. That, to me, would be a far more sensible. You'd make an economic or national security determination more broadly on how much you can afford, but then don't micromanage the process. Which gets me to the other point, the first question. What I try to do is introduce a national security filter or lens to a lot of these decisions that are too often seen in this silo called domestic. And again, whether it is education or something like tax policy and all that, my argument is simply we're not going to be able to be strong for long unless we put this economy on a sustainable trajectory, that we reduce our vulnerability to potential cutoffs of flows of dollars or what have you. And that, among more than anything, is going to mean in the long run fixing entitlements. And there are sensible things that can be done on Social Security and even more on Medicare, which is the bulk of it. Tax expenditures, areas where we may want to put some ceiling on what kind of limits on deductions that people can take, or means testing certain aspects of our policy, I think, again, makes sense. What I'm trying to say is that we don't have the luxury of seeing these things somehow divorced from our national security. I want to have a more integrated debate in this country. So, because I think too many people on the Hill have basically said, I'm all in favor of America's national security, but then when they turn to economic issues or quote-unquote social issues, they haven't approached them thinking about what the consequences are for national security. So what I want to do is increasingly integrate the how we spend, because then people can think more systematically about the trade-offs.
The lady way in the back there, thank you.
Hi, I'm Catherine Cheney, and I'm a reporter for World Politics Review. I was just wondering, in your section looking at restoration within the country, how you selected the areas of focus that you decided to focus on. So first of all, how you selected those subjects, and secondly, are there any other areas that you didn't include in the book, perhaps because they didn't, work on their own, but where you would suggest the U.S. place its focus in terms of solving domestic problems?
Well, I just chose the areas I chose: infrastructure, immigration, schools, the budget, and so forth. Tax policy, just because I thought they were the most important. And when I read a lot of literature, and you know, as EJ suggested, that I had not been reading for a while, and one of the, you know, as one of the, for me, interesting parts of this was to explore more fully, you know, debates outside the traditional foreign policy, national security landscape. And it just increasingly became clear that these were the principal drivers. So if you're going to make a list of what was driving things, this is where I came out. I think ultimately you could have an almost unlimited list. If you looked at the budget, you could look at every category of things we were spending on. You could look at all sorts of political arrangements. And I just chose the ones I did simply based upon what I thought explained most where we were. But look, I'm not saying I'm necessarily right. And I actually, look, whenever an author writes a book, you never expect to have the last word. I would love for that debate to happen. I would love to have more people look at more aspects of our society, our economy, and basically say, hey, we've got to do this differently because here's the connections. Here's the repercussions or implications of this for U.S. National security. That would be one thing I write about in the book goes way beyond K-12 education is we don't have in this country a very good capacity to think about lifelong education. Just to give you a one-minute conversation about it, most of the education in this country is front-loaded, whether high school, college, even graduate school. No matter how you slice and dice it, unless your kid is on the 15-year plan, you're going to be done with your formal education somewhere in your early to mid-20s. Well, then given now life expectancy and given jobs and the rest, that probably means you've got 4 to 5 decades at least of work after that. Well, the idea that this initial tank of intellectual gas is going to get you through the next 40 or 50 years, inconceivable. Inconceivable. Technology is changing too fast. Globalization is too dynamic. So what are we as a society going to do to put into place mechanisms for true lifelong learning? Lots of stuff is happening now online. Maybe that's part of the answer. It might mean certain types of economic arrangements, tax benefits, or different types of support so people at the age of 45 can get retrained. Otherwise, I worry about a society where people suddenly, they're trained, they do several jobs, but then suddenly in their mid-40s, they're no longer, if you will, their skill set is no longer adequate. We can't afford as a society long-term unemployment, which is part of the problem we're facing now. So what do we do about it? That to me is a useful debate that we really haven't had.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I can remember how it started. I followed the firemen. I dreamed of the astronauts. They looked so happy in their shiny metal headgear. I knew that inside they were smiling. Feared I was abnormal. I'd take out the colander and put it on my head. People are happy when they know that they're protected. Just let me tell you why I'm smiling.
I've got my helmet on. Nothing can do me wrong. I've got my helmet on.
In shining rows they sit in every beauty parlor. Down in the coal mines lighting the way. From distant battlefields to the tiniest motor scooter, there is peace on every single face.
My friends all tell me I'm retreating, but how can they argue with true serenity? If they would only try just once to wear a helmet, the world would soon be a better place.
Come try my helmet on, nothing will do you wrong. Come try my helmet on.
In shining rows they sit in every beauty parlor. Serenity on every face.
Come tie my helmet on, nothing will do you wrong. Come tie my helmet on. Come tie my helmet on, nothing will do you wrong. Come tie my helmet on. Come tie my helmet on, nothing will do you wrong. Come tie my helmet on.
And now back to Foreign Policy Begins at Home with Richard Haass and E.J. Dionne.
Moving right up the line, that gentleman in the aisle, and then Avis.
Paul Denig, Department of State. Dr. Haass, you mentioned that having a doctrine is very important as we approach foreign policy and national security policy, and later you commented that inconsistency can be a virtue. On the face of it, the two seem contradictory. How do you square the circle?
Excellent question. Inconsistency is a doctrine, I suppose.
The answer is the following. A doctrine gives you a framework. It gives you a first-order way of thinking through things. It may be in particular cases you've got to make exceptions, fair enough. Then it makes you aware of just that, of the trade-offs. But it gives you a going-in position. In my going-in position, for example, I would say we want to do less in the Middle East, all things being equal, more in Asia, more in North America, more domestically. Okay. So then I come up against Assyria. And then it informs me to say, okay, I probably then want to put a limit on what it is we can do there for all these reasons based upon my doctrine. My knowledge or experts tell me is the reality of Syria reinforces that approach. Now, again, a doctrine is not a straitjacket. We had a doctrine of containment during the Cold War. It doesn't provide 26-point step, answers to every challenge. A doctrine is it's a 36,000 feet intellectual and political approach. But that's useful. It's a very good way for, again, approaching subjects. It's a very good way for explaining things. And when you have to make exceptions, when the local realities point you towards, if you will, inconsistency, then that's okay. But then you know you've got to deal with that, whether it's in your public explanation or you've got to account for it as a potential cost.
Avis Boland, right up there. If you guys can stay sort of up front, because then we'll move. Oh,
and there's a young lady just in front of Avis.
Okay. All sides. Avis Boland, retired State Department. Richard, first of all, I was sorry to hear you use the term weapons of mass destruction. Couldn't we retire that from the vocabulary, because it embraces everything from nuclear to chemical? And you know better than anyone what abusive use was made of it in the run-up to the Iraq War. My question is, you said it may take a crisis to get us to get our act together. We've just been through a very serious economic crisis. And why is it that so little has changed? Right. Why was this not a learning moment? Was it lack of leadership on the part of the administration? Was it the political gridlock? How would you?
It's a good point. Look, on the question of weapons of mass destruction, I take your point. Indeed, I was recently criticized. Inconsistency among my critics must also be a virtue. I was recently criticized, I think it was this weekend, for trying to do what you just suggested, for suggesting that not all quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction ought to be captured under the same, and that chemical weapons ought to be considered as something different. And I got chastised for that, but let's put that aside. Look, you're right, we have had crises on many issues over the years, most recently 2008, and that wasn't enough, which is interesting. It's one of the reasons that those who say that it's going to take a crisis to shake things up, well, medium-sized crises don't seem to do it. So what that suggests to me, the crisis might have to be of truly draconian proportions, which again reinforces my argument that's the worst possible way to undertake reforms. But we seem to have a considerable ability to avoid taking tough decisions, or we go back to business as usual. Look, we had the situation in Newton, Connecticut. We had a terrible incident. 90% of the American people want action on gun control, and then we can't even get a piece of legislation with fairly basic background checks passed. So that was a recent example of a crisis that didn't, at least so far at least, has not led to political action. So the ability to translate from crisis to action, particularly legislative action, is obviously not one-to-one. and which again suggests to me that it may take extremely severe outcomes, which is exactly what we don't want to wait for. So it makes the case for leadership before the crisis forces our hand under truly awful circumstances.
That young lady there that Richard called on, go ahead.
Rebecca Chamberlain. I'm a current International Affairs Fellow with the Council. Fantastic. And currently at the World Bank. And so my question is I like what you're saying, and it reminds me very much of a paper I read, an influential, notable paper when I was at the Wilson Center called the Mr. Why paper. And it was resonating very much with what you're saying about national security beginning at home. So I'm just wondering how you see your book maybe intersecting with or differing from this Mr. Why paper.
Alas, I do not know Mr. Why. Look, I don't...
But by the way, this book, this title was used before.
Yeah, 60 years ago.
By James Warburg.
Right.
Which Richard notes in the book,
just to be clear. Yeah, look, I would hope this idea is one that resonates. I'm not familiar with what you just alluded to. People have, there's been something, there's an intellectual marketplace. People have been putting out ideas for what we should and should not be doing abroad and at home. I would hope there's other people putting out similar ideas. I'd welcome the competition if people are putting out alternative ideas. As a former president once said in a very different context, bring it on. I think it'd be healthy. It's a healthy debate for the American body politic.
The outcome of that wasn't ideal, however. The lady
good point.
Right here.
Good point.
Please.
Won't use that line again.
Thank you.
Hi, Priscilla Clapp, also retired from Foreign Service.
Thank all you Foreign Service officers, by the way.
I agree with much of what you're saying, if not everything, Richard. And when I think about the solutions you're suggesting, I keep coming back to our Congress. Now, I haven't read your book yet, so I don't know what you say about them, but I'm just so distraught about the state of our political system, particularly in the Congress, the way it's chosen, the fact that people have to spend all their time raising money rather than thinking about the country's problems. Is there any way to fix that?
It's because of the Babylon and the situation. When I was a boy about 8 years old, there was a certain Rasta man, and he loved all the children, and he treated us like a man. Even the little children that no one cares for, he called up everyone, and he gave us fruit and treated everyone with a special love. Many people see I, many people ask I, why am I a Rasta man? But he taught I the love to give to everyone. Many people see I, many people ask I, why am I a Rasta man? There is no better way to express my love to each and everyone. One Saturday morning, a special thing happened to this man. Here comes Mr. Babylon to take away the Rasta man. So they root up him herb and then eat off him fruit and throw it in a van. And straight after that for 3 long years I never see the Rasta man. They took him to General Penitentiary and them sent him back as a valid man. But God could not change him, his mind was not in prison, was only his body man. Ooh. Many people see I, many people ask I, why am I a Rasta man? No matter what the battle be, I still am trying my hand. Many people see I, many people ask I, why am I a Rasta man? How sweet the name of Georgia sound to every righteous Rasta man. And the same old Rasta man told me pound, shilling and pins would come out of circulation, and we would use that shoot, Birdman. And I have seen 7 years after that, it was no use, man. Donkey horses and cows keep on trotting up and weeping him, man. Hey, everyone I see, I, everyone ask, I, why am I a Rasta, man? I'm here to prove and to testify about prophecy. Everyone I see, I, everyone ask, I, why am I a Rasta, man? John the Baptist, Marcus, Gavi, and Christ, they was a Rasta, man. Everyone see, I, everyone ask, I, why am I a Rasta, man? I bow the bow up a Nazarite, and I can't do no otherwise, man. Everyone see, I, everyone ask, I, why am I a Rasta, man? I love my brothers and my sisters, and I cannot give up at all, man. Brother Brown, Brother Coos, Brother Tom, Brother Stanley, man. I used to hear them beat the drum and sing way in the forest land. Hey, everyone see, I, everyone ask, why am I a Rasta, man? I love the beat of the Naya Bingi that calls at creation.
And now for something completely different.